We're joined by Yanis Varoufakis. His new book is And the Weak Suffer What They Must, Europe, Austerity and the Threat to Global Stability. Former Greek finance minister, he made a big name for himself. You'll remember when Greece essentially went bankrupt and needed to negotiate bailouts, and he walked out of the government because he wasn't prepared to do business with the terms that the European bosses were offering. Welcome. Good afternoon. Welcome to the programme. Kalimera, I should say. Good afternoon.
It is wonderful to be in Belfast.
Can I ask you the most popular question that's already flooding into this building? And
please,
that is your view on what Brexit is likely to mean here in Northern Ireland, which will, when Britain leaves the European Union, will be the only part of the United Kingdom which has a land border with one of the remaining states of the EU. What do you think is likely to happen here?
I don't think that we should be indulging in predictions. We should be taking steps to prevent bad outcomes instead. This is an indeterminate process. We don't know what's going to happen. I don't think anyone does. My experience of negotiating with Brussels is that you have to negotiate for the right to negotiate, and then you don't even get that. So the most important thing from the perspective of Northern Ireland is the Good Friday Agreement. Every aspect of it is interwoven with the EU. The border is not just, is not the only aspect of it which matters. Every aspect of the peace deal, which has given a new lease of life to Northern Ireland, which has made all of us in the rest of Europe very proud to have played even indirectly some role in resolving the troubles and in giving the people in this part of the world, in this part of Europe, hope, that we should make sure that the shenanigans between London and Brussels and Berlin and Paris and so on do not end up having detrimental effects on the lives of people in Ireland.
That's a stark analysis, because others will say, look, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is an international agreement between Britain and Ireland, involves the parties in Northern Ireland. It will continue even if Britain leaves the EU. And this is actually quite dangerous talk to suggest that that could unravel.
No, I do hope it continues. It must continue. And I agree entirely that it probably will. But every aspect of it, if you look at the funding of the various initiatives, it comes from the EU.
European peace money, structural fund investment, regional fund investment.
The manner in which conflicts that have not even occurred yet are resolved is also intertwined with EU institutions. So whatever the arguments in favour or against Brexit in the rest of the United Kingdom might be, the relationship between the Good Friday Agreement and its smooth functioning, especially at the time of crisis, which has resulted in the election that we are now having in the Northern Ireland, the relationship between the functioning of the Good Friday Agreement and the EU and this whole process. Remember, the EU is not a given. The EU is in an advanced stage of disintegration. Its disintegration is not going to leave the Good Friday Agreement unaffected.
03030 80 55 55. I've challenged you to call and ask Yanis Varoufakis anything really, to about our financial world, Europe, the future of the world after Donald Trump, anything you want to talk to him about today. And as you can tell from his first couple of answers there, he's across some of the things happening in Northern Ireland already. Mark, welcome. Good afternoon, sir. Hello, Mark.
Oh, hello. How are you doing?
Mark, your question for Yanis.
Yeah, I'm not going to the nutty gritty. He might know a nutty gritty yet. Politics and more. In the north here, but anyway, I would like to ask him, what would he have done as finance minister? What would he have done if a department under him squandered £500 million? What would have happened to the head of departments and that department and his government?
All right, so we're talking about the RHI scandal, the Cash for Ash scandal here. I think you're across some of that.
Yes, I am familiar with this.
And what's happened. And of course, the government is trying at some level to reduce the possible overspend in the future with some new proposals. And we're going to an election while all of that was being developed. Your thoughts on that?
Well, when I read about this story, the first question that popped in my head was this a conspiracy or was this a cock-up? And increasingly, it looks as if it was a cock-up. Now, when there's a cock-up in government which costs taxpayers money, somebody has to pay for it. Somebody has to take the rap and somebody has to come out and admit error. So I think that's the most important thing. Politicians have a tendency to hide behind excuses. I do not believe that this is appropriate, especially when you have a situation like Northern Ireland, where government is precariously positioned on a knife's edge due to the importance of maintaining an accord between foes, between the DUP and Sinn Féin, for instance. It's important that you don't jeopardise the stability of Northern Ireland because of a cock-up.
Thank you very much. And we go on to Dolores. Hello, Dolores.
Hello, William. Hello, Mr. Varoufakis. I wanted to ask Mr. Varoufakis about Greece. Now, from what I followed all along, I have a great appreciation of his, how shall I say it, stance when he left the ministry. Now, as far as I can see, what happened in Greece is threatening other countries. You know, the IMF comes in, and the country ends up on its knees. The country gets asset stripped and ends up with a big, big, big debt that can never be paid. How do you feel about that?
Well, this is my constant pain and concern. Thank you for making this point. Look, the situation is very, very simple. Before 2008, the global financial crisis, we had a frenzy of Ponzi schemes all around Europe.
Yes.
Not just in, you have Ireland had it.
Yes.
Britain had it. Think of the City of London. Frankfurt banks were a part of it. The Parisian banks were just completely immersed in these pyramids of phony value. And Greece was part of it. Now, Greece, of course, was the weakest link, the canary in the mine. And, of course, you know, when the European Union capitalist economy gets cold, the canary gets pneumonia and starts dying. Now, the obvious thing to have done in 2010 when our state, our government went bankrupt was to admit it, to say, sorry, guys, you know, we did everything wrong, and we got bankrupt. Instead, in their infinite wisdom, in inverted commas, the European Union and the International Monetary Fund rushed in there to give the largest loan in human history to the most bankrupt state in Europe on conditions of austerity that would sap the incomes from which the old and the new debts would be paid. Now, how old do you need to be to realize that this is not going to end well? 8, 9, at most 10 years old. And, you know, for 6 years, this extend and pretend austerity-driven recession has created a humanitarian crisis. And people like me were elected, not because I wanted to be elected or because the Greek electorate suddenly went radical and wanted to elect somebody like me. I got elected for a very simple reason, because I said to the Greek people, to my electorate, somebody has to go to Brussels and to Paris and to Berlin and to Washington, D.C., where the IMF is, and tell them that this is not going to go on. We're not going to get another credit card out, keep pretending that we've paid the previous one. And let's sit down and compromise. I wanted to compromise. They didn't. They wanted to give us another credit card. And I said, no, we're not going to do this. And you can shoot me. You can belittle me. You can present me as the most recalcitrant person in the world. But I'm not going to sign another loan agreement when I know that I can't repay the money. This is just basic human decency.
I described you earlier as a bit of a nightmare to some of these people. You wear that as a badge of honour, don't you?
But you see, the only reason... Let me put it this way. It depends on your definition of negotiations. I wanted to negotiate. At some point, Barack Obama, when we met at the White House, said, Yanis, look, you really have to compromise. I said, Mr. President, I go to bed every night and I wake up every morning dreaming of compromising. I want to compromise. But on what? They don't want to have a discussion with me. They want my capitulation. They want me to sign on the dotted line that I'm going to take another wad of money when I know I cannot repay their taxpayers for it. That I'm not going to do. Then I would be compromised. There is a profound difference between compromising and being compromised. The people of Northern Ireland, I'm sure, in every community in this land, understand that.
Do you think the party that you you served with in that government for 6 months or so as finance minister, do you think they've compromised?
Well, there's no doubt about that. They are compromised.
They've folded on their principles.
Oh, completely and utterly. They've surrendered.
Syriza.
Yep. They surrendered. I was never a member of the party. I was enlisted by the Prime Minister, the incoming Prime Minister, because he claimed to agree with my analysis of what needed to be done. For me, it was just, you know, national duty.
Given what you've said, and you just said in the last couple of days, I think it's a direct quote, the European Union is very good at being terrible about its approach to these financial issues. You've been one of the European Union's greatest, most scathing critics in terms of the democratic deficit of Europe. You've described its foundations as a cartel, and you've described its wanderings through the last 40 years in very, very negative terms. Why do you still want to maintain the European Union going forward from here? Wouldn't it be better to collapse it?
You know, William, I'm a patriot. I'm a Greek patriot. I love my country. And yet I've spent almost every year of my existence, since I remember, criticising my government. Because I believe that patriots should criticise their government when their government is wrong. That does not mean I want to dismantle Greece. Equally, I'm a Europeanist. I don't actually, you know what? I don't like borders. I really don't like the peace wars.
You're an internationalist.
Here. I do not like the Berlin Wall. I do not like any border. I mean, when every time I see a border, I try to imagine what Earth would look like from space if you were an alien. And looking at all these borders that people draw and they defend with flags and with their blood and so on, I don't need this to have my identity as a Greek. And I don't believe that you need it in order to be a Protestant, a Catholic, a nationalist, a Republican, whatever, you know, a unionist. You can have your identity without having those godforsaken divisions between people's houses, between people's lands and so on and so forth. So this is why I'm a Europeanist. And I believe that, look, the Greens, the ecological movement, have taught us an important lesson. The greatest problems facing humanity are common. There is nothing that Northern Ireland can do to stem climate change. There's nothing Greece can do. There's nothing Germany can do. But we can together do something about it. Similarly, with underinvestment, with unemployment, with the banking crisis. There's nothing Northern Ireland can do to avert banking crisis or underinvestment. But as Europeans, together, we can. Now, the fact that Brussels is a cesspool of inanity does not mean that we should retreat back into our little cocoons and build tall walls and electrified fences on top of them.
Our phone lines are going crazy. People are flooding calls into the building. I'm going to step back a little bit, not ask too many more questions, because I want to give our callers the chance to talk to you. On this borders question, let's go to John. John, you want to pick up on that. Welcome, John.
Yeah, I was wondering, could he give his opinion on what's going to happen on the north and south of Ireland? Is it going to be a hard border, a soft border, if that happens to be? Is it going to be an electronic border, or will there be no border at all?
If Britain leaves the European Union, and that looks pretty much certain at this point, what kind of border do you anticipate we're going to have?
Well, it's not going to be business as usual. There's going to be a border. Now, whether it's going to be a virtual border, as I read recently being discussed, where effectively you can cross without even noticing where the border is, but then you get pulled over by police, you know, 4 miles down the road to be checked in a car park that is not exactly on the border, that's a border still. I don't believe that Ireland should have a border dissecting it. And unfortunately, the way that Theresa May has underwent an Ovidian metamorphosis from a mild Remainer to a hard Brexiteer doesn't augur well for the manner in which we are going to resolve this problem. And I say we, because I believe that all of us Europeans have an interest to make sure that there is no hard border, soft border, or any kind of border separating the north of Ireland from the Republic.
Thank you very much, John. Can we go to Fred? Hello, Fred.
Hello.
Fred, your question for Yanis.
How is a man from a country that's gone to debt should be telling us how to run our country? I just don't understand that bit.
How could somebody from a country that's bankrupt essentially be telling the rest of us how we should organise our affairs?
Well, John, if you are
Fred.
If somebody wants to overcome alcoholism, speaking to a recovering alcoholic is not a bad idea, you know. Remember, the reason why I got elected was not in order to create debt. I was elected because I was one of the economists who were warning in the 1980s, the 1990s, and the 2000s, all our governments, that the way we were going, not just our governments, but the European Union as well, we're going to end up with a great major explosion of debt.
Did you foresee the crash? In print,
I can tell you that, it is in print. I wrote an article in 2003 in which I was talking about the real estate crisis leading to a banking crisis. And in 2006, interestingly, this was in Greek, so that there is a translation somewhere. I gave a talk in Athens in which I was explaining how the oncoming onslaught of a shockwave from Wall Street is going to flatten Greece. So having experienced the manner in which unsustainable debt is built up and having struggled to have it restructured, well, maybe if you want to know something about the problems of debt and how to avoid them, I'm not such a bad person to talk to.
Connor, does that satisfy you? Sorry, Fred, does that satisfy you?
Well, yes, it does, but we used to hear in years past of the Greek magnates and the great word all the money they had. Where did all that money go to?
I'll tell
you. Did they draw it into themselves and then disappear with it or sink their ships?
I can tell you where it's gone. By the way, let me inform you that during all those years of the Ponzi schemes in Greece that enriched quite a few people, I was out on the streets of Athens demonstrating against them. So I think I have the credentials to speak about that. Now, where has the money gone? All right. Here's the list. The banks of Frankfurt, Geneva, Lausanne, the City of London, New York, Singapore, Cayman Islands. Most of the money is there. And Luxembourg. Most of the money is there.
The word missing from that list is Greece.
Of course it's not in Greece. The whole point was to make it and take it out and stash it.
Thank you very much, Fred. 0330 80 55 55. We'll rush through some of them. I mentioned Connor a minute ago. Connor, you're next. Welcome, sir.
Thanks, William, and you're very welcome to Belfast, Seamus. And just quick questions. We were told years ago, or I suppose our parents were told years ago, as technology advanced, the working week would get shorter, and if anything, the working week's getting longer. And is that down to some planned demand, or is that just greed? The issue around also is our governments now turning into HR departments for big business, and if privatisation is so good, why are taxes so high?
You are hitting the nail on the head, because humanity has made incredible progress technologically. We now have machines that they're amazingly productive, and in the next 2 or 3 years, automation is going to be exponential in its capacity to replace human toil. Now, we humans should end up being the recipients of the benefits, and we should spread them around. I keep using a metaphor, if you permit me, Connor, of our future, given technological innovation. And it's science fiction based. Our future is either going to look like Star Trek, which is a good outcome, that is, machines in the wall providing you with everything you want so you don't have to work and you can sit around the table and have philosophical discussions or explore the universe. Or we're going to end up like the Matrix, where we humans are the slaves of the machines that we created. Now, at the moment, it looks like the bad scenario unfolding, the Matrix scenario unfolding. You made the point. Instead of reducing our hours of work, increasing our leisure, increasing our capacity to philosophize and to have wonderful discussions around the table like the rich like to do, instead of that, we are enmeshed in greater conflict and more anxiety and greater crisis. And that is not the fault of the technology. It's the fault of the social arrangements by which we do the business of redistributing the goodies from production.
Connor, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, it's just that I think everybody feels the same way now, and I think it's common knowledge that we are now working for the economy instead of the economy working for us, and we are literally just turned into batteries, and our universities and education structures are now reserved for those, for the rich. And so, as I say, it's the human toil is now the name of the game. And as I say, the issue around our governments who are so-called democratically elected have now just turned into the HR departments for some of the biggest businesses in the world. And you know, The other issue is, as I said, about privatisation. The whole point of privatisation, according to the governments, is it would be easier on the taxpayer. If not, it's worse. It's 10 times worse on the taxpayer with privatisation. So, you know, as Yanis is right, it does feel a bit like the Matrix, unfortunately, but that's the way it is.
Connor, thanks very much. And this is happening. Robotics is being talked about a lot in the United States. If you ever watch American news, we don't talk about it much here, but there's a big fear there that is going to take the jobs away from the American population, not in the next 100 years, in the next 10 years.
In the next 3 years.
The next 3 years.
You see, look, that fear has always been with humans, that machines will destroy jobs and push us out of the economy. It hasn't happened in the last 200 years or so. Why? Because every time a technology has displaced people from work, it has created more jobs than it destroyed.
Right.
But now we are on the cusp of a historic change where the new artificial intelligence-based technologies are going to destroy a lot more jobs than they will create. And that is when the moment that machines can emulate humans in terms of the services industry, the services sector. So imagine all the call centers going because, you know, computers can actually recognize your voice and give you an answer on the phone without you realizing that it's a machine speaking to you. That is going to create huge unemployment from India to Texas. And then, of course, all sorts of white-collar jobs, like legal professions, where a lot of the research that they do will be replaced by machines. Mm. So we now have a combination of two things. Firstly, this displacement effect overcoming the new job creation effect. And secondly, and that's very important, capital is being increasingly socialized in terms of its production. Think about it. Once upon a time, James Watt created a steam engine. Whoever owned it, owned it. That's it. Finished. Capital was privately produced, privately owned. Mm. But now, every time you and I and our listeners search something on the Google search engine, we are contributing to the capital of Google, but we're not shareholders of Google. So we need to socialize capital. And the only way of doing this is by extending the realm of democracy into the economic sphere.
What do you make of Donald Trump?
He's a very dangerous character a character that, like Benito Mussolini in the 1920s and 1930s, is quite alluring. Remember, Mussolini, something that most people forget. First thing Mussolini did when he won office, when he became the leader of the Italian Republic at the time, first thing he did was he met trade unionists and got on very well with them and offered them social security. The welfare state was not created after 1945 under the Attlee government in the United Kingdom. It started under Mussolini. But the whole point of people like Mussolini and Trump, by the way, I'm saying this because Donald Trump's first meeting after his inauguration was with trade unions. I think this is a rather worrying. As a left winger, I'm saying this, that this is rather worrying. The attempt to co-opt the trade unions and the working class, the blue-collar workers, and the people who feel that they've been discarded for so many years, not in order to serve their interests, but in order to co-opt them, in order to turn them against their own interests, to enlist them into a racist, nationalist narrative, which in the end is detrimental to the interests of the working class.
You've definitely got a populist movement and a nationalistic populist movement with Donald Trump, but isn't it an overreach to use analogies with fascism?
No, it's not. Fascism was all about, remember the roots of Mussolini, Socialist Party. That's where how he started. The whole point was to do exactly that which Trump is heralding. What is it? To protect industry by means of tariffs, to have an agreement with trade unions, with the working class, whereby Trump is telling them, I'm going to look after you in terms of minimum wages and some infrastructural spending so that we have jobs and you're not completely discarded. But what you're going to do is you're going to accept complete subjugation to my authority, to my increasing authoritarianism, to the narrative of America first or Italy first. So if there are historical parallels, we should draw them.
Let's go back to the call. 03030 80 55 55. Graham, thank you very much for waiting for so long for us. Graham, go for it.
Good afternoon, William. Good afternoon, Yanis. Yanis, I'd like your opinion on the fact whether this was true or otherwise. It's widely reported here that Greece actually misled the EU, and in particular the IMF, in relation to its financial status before joining the EU, and as such never really qualified on those grounds. And as you have qualified and come in, you're now reaping what you sow. So what's your opinion on that?
No, I agree. I agree. And it's not just me who agrees. The good people in Washington, D.C. working for the IMF agree. As we speak, there is a revolt within the International Monetary Fund of analysts and people who are actually doing the hard yakka, the hard work, as Australians might say, and the leadership of the IMF, who are rather cynical in their pursuit of their own political careers, primarily in Europe, against the interests even of the IMF.
Thank you very much for that, Graham. Robert, welcome.
Good afternoon, William. Good afternoon, Yanis. I'd like to ask you two quick points. Would the European Union have been more secure if every country had a state in their own currency? And also, should super wealthy people that earn large money in countries be able to put it in tax havens around the world?
Yes, of course. Look, the idea of a common currency is not a bad one, as long as it's designed properly. But the way we designed the euro, it was as if we tried to... It was the equivalent of removing the shock absorbers from your car and driving it into a pothole, to put it bluntly.
What was the pothole?
Well, the pothole
the crash?
Was 2008.
Yeah.
This expansion of financialization, when the banks, there was no banking union, there was no fiscal union, the banks of Ireland went bust, and suddenly their huge losses could not be covered by the central bank. They had to be rolled over onto the weakest shoulders, the shoulders of the weakest taxpayers in Ireland and in Greece and so on and so forth. Now, regarding tax havens, now, my country is renowned for tax evasion. It goes back a long way. I mean, we can have a discussion about that. Getting people to pay tax in Greece has never been an easy job. It's a little bit like a patriotic duty to evade. So we've changed that to a very large extent. People pay taxes. But think about Luxembourg and a certain Mr. Jean-Claude Juncker, who happens to be the president of the European Commission. He was the prime minister of Luxembourg, which is a tax haven within the European Union. They were Greeks have nothing to teach Jean-Claude Juncker over tax evasion. I mean, he turned it into a mass industry. We are just little nitpickers compared to him.
We'll go to Harry. Thank you very much for that call, Robert. Harry, welcome.
Hello, yes. Just to hark back to the border statement about not liking borders, I think that the greatest guarantee of the standard of living of the poorest people in our society is the national border. So, and also, I don't understand why Mr. Varoufakis makes this distinction between a very strong border to repel the third world immigrants, but no borders within within Europe.
Well, I must on the last point that you made, let me say that I think I'm consistent. I don't like any borders, not even the EU borders, especially the EU borders with the rest of the world. I find them cruel, and I find them inhuman. The way that we treat the refugees that are landing on the Greek islands at the moment is a source of great pain for me and regret and shame as a European. But let me make the point that the greatest guarantee of prosperity is not a border, if I'm allowed to say. It is investment. That is the key. And the reason why we are down the dumps throughout Europe now since 2008 is a startling fact that we have the lowest level of investment in physical capital, in things, in material things, in machines, in farms, in schools. The lowest level of investment as a proportion to national income in Europe as a whole, in Britain as well, and in Northern Ireland, and in Ireland, and in Greece, and in Germany, since 1945, compared to the highest level of savings that we've had. That you only have to state this to realise what the problem of what the basis of the problem is.
But Harry's now, point far, is, would you far, not be concerned about losing borders and then unlimited immigration?
Let me remind you of a country that has the strongest border on Earth, and yet is absolutely miserable. North Korea. A strong border doesn't bring prosperity, and it doesn't even bring security. Think about the peace walls in this beautiful city. Have they brought security? I don't think so. I think they breed insecurity, and they breed conflicts that our peoples can do without.
Harry, thank you very much. Andrew's there. Andrew, I'm so sorry. I've left you waiting for a very, very long time. Your question for Yanis.
Thanks, William. Good afternoon, Yanis. My question is, do you think the ECB's quantitative easing policy has been successful? And do you think the money could have been better spent?
That's the European Central Bank printing money, essentially.
Yes. It's been successful in the sense of not having allowed the euro to collapse. But it's a
the Holy Grail. Whatever happens, the euro cannot collapse.
Well, yes. The whatever it takes speech by Mario Draghi in 2012 in London. But it can't last. It's a little bit like cortisone to a cancer patient. It props you up, makes you feel better. You look a little bit more perky, but the tumour is doing its evil deed under the skin.
The eurozone is a cancerous zone.
No, the eurozone has a cancer in it. And it's the financial and trade imbalances within it that are tearing it apart.
Doomed, is it?
And the QE...
I think it's doomed.
The way we're going, yes. The quantitative easing program, effectively, it was the cortisone that made those imbalances disappear from public view while they were doing their evil deed under the surface. Rendering, for instance, forget Greece for a moment, Italy absolutely unsustainable at the moment. Now, your second question was, could it be spent better? Absolutely. Imagine if we had the European Investment Bank announce a very large-scale investment program for the whole of Europe, including for the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, since the European Investment Bank belongs to all EU member states. 5% of European GDP to be ploughed into a new deal, something like what FDR did in 1933 in the United States, with money that it gets from, it raises from the money markets, issuing EIB bonds. And quantitative easing, the ECB, buying those bonds. Now, that's a good way of spending the quantitative easing money because it goes directly into investment to things society needs.
So we're mixing our metaphors here a bit, but you think Britain dodged a bullet by not going into the euro?
Oh, absolutely.
It's one of the few things you agree with Margaret Thatcher on.
That is indeed the case. And one of the reasons why I'm a very good friend with Norman Lamont.
Would you consider emigrating and standing for office in Northern Ireland?
Why would I want to do this?
I warn you against that.
To the great people of Northern Ireland. I do believe that we Europeans must create transnational political movements. That is what we've done with DiEM25, the Democracy in Europe movement.
Which is what brings you to Belfast today.
Which is what brings me here today. And tonight we're going to be together, I believe,
yes,
discussing it. You see, I don't think that Europe is something out there, something away from us. Europe must be utilised as a mechanism by which to delve into our local problems. And to delve into them in a manner which is humane and effective.
That event that Yanis is talking about, and don't try and get a ticket for that. It's going to be sold out since the minute they advertised it, within an hour, I think. But many people coming tonight to hear him talk more about these issues in the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast. Paul asked the question, do you think Greece will be in or out of the EU in 5 years' time?
The better question is there going to be an EU in 5 years' time?
How unlikely is that?
Well, it's not a question. Look, you can predict rain or snow or hail scientifically because it is a natural phenomenon. But the EU is a political phenomenon. I mean, we could fix the EU tomorrow. It could within a week, we could fix the EU. Technically, you can do it really easily. But what we have is a major political failure. And when politics is a human business, so therefore, because of our amazing capacity to be unpredictable as human beings and to fail spectacularly when we don't need to, it's impossible to predict. So yeah, I could give you probabilities, but they wouldn't make much sense. And as I said, what really matters is action. We are in this polis together. In this polis is the Greek word for city.
Well, what do you think of
that's
those?
Politics.
What do you think of those left of centre campaigners? We've got some in Northern Ireland with People Before Profit, Eamon McCann, for example, who supported Brexit, who thought that this was basically a European neoliberal bosses' club. Why would you want to be part of that from a left perspective? That's the critique.
Well, my message to my comrades on the left is that. Think about how the left began in the 18th, 19th century. it began with a very severe criticism of the bosses and the lords' state and the narrative on how to be in and against, to penetrate, to use whatever popular support in order to get inside the institutions of the state and turn them in favor of the people as opposed to against the people. Now, why don't we want to do the same thing with the European Union, since our problems are common? And finally, if we start advocating the disintegration of the EU as left-wingers, we're going to end up regretting our wishes, because the only ones who are going to benefit from the disintegration of the EU, of this neoliberal, terrible, awful EU, nobody knows how awful it is better than me, but the only ones who are going to benefit from its disintegration are the nationalists who really want to have us for breakfast as leftists. And, you know, just like in the 1930s, think of who benefited from the disintegration of Europe. It was not the good left-wing comrades who wanted peace and happiness for everyone. It was rather sinister characters that won.
In case you're wondering, we've cleared the deck. So many calls, so many texts, so many tweets. People want to have an argument. People want to put questions. People want to learn from Yanis Varoufakis today and also challenge some of the things he's been saying. At 03030 80 55 55, we'll keep going until 1. Mary Jane, first time caller, I think. Mary Jane, welcome. Good afternoon,
Yanis. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on a universal basic income.
Universal basic income. Better explain what that is first for us, Yanis.
Well, it's the idea that every citizen, regardless of whether they're rich, poor, clever, stupid, lazy or hardworking, should receive a basic income that provides them with basic goods like shelter, food, energy, in order to liberate us from anxiety, and to liberate the social security system, the state, from having to find out who is deserving and who is not deserving, who has the right and who doesn't have the right. This is a very costly business, the process of checking for eligibility. My view, since you asked me, is that I'm against a UBI, universal basic income, that is funded from taxes, because that would be a substitute for the welfare state, and also politically it would be toxic and philosophically indefensible. There will be people who are hardworking who say, well, why should my taxes be used in order to pay for somebody to sit on their couch and watch television all day? And that would be a legitimate concern. Also, trade unionists would be against it, because they would see it as a way of relieving employers of their obligation to the workers and so on and so forth. But what I do believe in is a universal basic dividend. And what is the difference between dividend and a wage or any kind of benefit? A dividend is something that you get in income from capital. So if you own shares in Google or in Nestle, and you get a dividend.
Yeah.
Now, increasingly, we said this before, capital is socially produced. If you open your smartphone, everything in it has been produced by a government grant, everything. And yet the government in America, in Britain, it doesn't get a penny for it. It's Google and Sony and Apple and so on that get
it. All the science research that led to it.
Similarly, the stock of knowledge which is compiling, there are so many people contributing to the knowledge that some companies appropriate. So my point is very simple. From now on, every time there's a new IPO, a share issue by any corporation, 10% of it goes into a common fund that owns those shares and the dividends, and then distributed to the population. That is the only way that humanity can share in a fair and efficient way in the benefits from automation.
Mary Jane, thank you very much. Very interesting question. There's George. Hello, George.
Hi.
George in Hollywood today. Go for it.
We have been going to Greece for over 30 years. We have good Greek friends both in Athens and on the islands. And I understand that the retirement age is 53. Now, if you consider someone living to 70, to the university until 23, they then retire at 53, and that's 17 years. So the government has to fund them for 40 years while they work for 30 years. Surely somebody should have identified, and plus the taxation thing where they only pay what they think they should. Was this not all discussed and thought about before you joined the European Union? And I know you're invited in and the books were massaged to help you come in. But Well, where is it now? What's happening now?
All right, George, got the question. Thank you.
Well, let me say that one of the few things that the first things I did, not few things, one of the first things I did when I was in the finance ministry, I worked towards eliminating early retirements for precisely the reasons that you advocated. But let me tell you historically why that was the case. And by the way, it's not true that everybody retired at 53. Some people retired at 55, 57, no, not 53, 57, 58.
Some people don't retire.
Some people never retired. Some people keep working in the 70s because their pensions are so low anyway they can't live. But there is, let me tell you historically why that was. It was because we had no unemployment benefit and we had no social security payments. So take, for instance, an industrial area like Elefsis near Athens, where, you know, like it happens here in Northern Ireland, in the north of England and so on, they become rust belts. Jobs are lost, people become massively unemployed. Now, in civilized countries like the United Kingdom, like in France and Germany, these people get some payments. Social security, unemployment, they get something. In Greece, that did not exist. So the political pressure was relentless on the government to do something about them. So it was easy for politicians simply to push them onto the pension system and therefore making the pension system bankrupt. So, but I changed that. From now on, no one can... We introduced legislation where the absolute minimum retirement age is 65.
0-30-30-80-55-55. Martin, where are you today, Martin?
I'm in Birmingham.
Welcome, Martin. Go for it.
Hi. How you doing? I liked your song, by the way, Yanis, but one of the observations is that Glenn Frey, when he was writing that song, I think it was Glenn Frey, it was a metaphor for heroin, so I'm not sure whether it's a good analogy. But so the first question I wanted to ask, because I've always wanted to ask you this question, after the political mandate you gained in Greece, one of the criticisms levelled against you was that maybe you ran away from the situation, and secondly, what would you have done differently?
Okay. Well, firstly, don't forget that the greatest drug is power. And
you challenged him with the heroin analogy. He's going for it.
It is power. You should see how much they love to have their limos and their secretaries and run around, with their entourages. I was not one of them. I disliked all the trappings of office intensely. I was very, very pleased to have resigned.
You had a ministerial motorbike, though, didn't you?
I had my own motorbike. By the way, let me tell you the story about the motorbike. I'm a bond to motorcycles, always have been a proud motorcyclist. But, you know, Athens is notorious for its traffic, okay? Yeah. So being stuck in a ministerial car to go from A to B is a very poor use of one's very precious time. Secondly, I was the finance minister of a bankrupt country, and I walked into the ministry and there were two BMW 7 Series armor-plated limousines that had been purchased for 750,000 euros. And the first thing I did was to flog them off, to sell them. And instead, I used my motorcycle. I went quicker, it was more fun. And you know, I even entertained the hope that somebody would say, well done. No, I was lambasted for this.
Whether you rode or ran, did you walk away? Pick your own analogy.
Okay. Not in the slightest. I held on for dear life. I kept my ministry until the very last moment when there was no way I could hang on to it anymore. And why?
In order to stay, you would have had to sign off on the new.
That is right. The whole point of getting elected was not to take another credit card. So when we asked the Greek people, when after the ECB had closed down our banks and the people were terrorized, and the television channels were telling them that if they vote in the referendum in favour of our no to the new credit card, Armageddon would happen. And they said 62% no. And that night I walked into the prime ministerial residence full of enthusiasm, and there was my prime minister in tatters saying to me, it's time to surrender. And I said, no, it's not time to surrender. It's exactly the time to do the opposite. And he said, no, it's time to surrender. Well, he was the prime minister, and either I signed up on the dotted line or I resigned.
One or the other.
I did not run away.
Thank you very much. Eamon's there. Hello, Eamon.
Hello, yeah, it's a wee quick question. I want to know how you feel about the Elgin marbles that the British stole off you.
The Elgin marbles. Your thoughts on the Elgin marbles.
Well, I don't believe that these marbles belong to anyone. I don't believe they belong to the British Museum, to me, to the Greeks, to the Chinese, to anyone. I think they belong to the Parthenon, which is where they came out of. And what saddens me is that the Greek government, a few years ago, not our government, other governments, made a very good offer to the British Museum and to the British. I think it's a very fair offer. Most people don't know about it. The offer was, okay, keep ownership of them, But let them come back to the Parthenon. And what we're going to do as a Greek government, we are going to compensate you with treasures from our archaeological museum that you can display in the British Museum, and you can have a rolling exhibition.
On loan.
On loan. You can keep getting them. Maybe sometime the marbles can come back to the British Museum and they can circulate. That would have been a fantastic deal, and unfortunately it was turned down.
Didn't go for it. Do you agree that they were stolen? Eamon,
of course they were stolen.
Yeah.
Not only were they stolen, but they were vandalised. And this is the worst part. Now try to picture the scene where there are these people who are climbing up on the metope of the Parthenon and hacking them off and throwing them off. They fall on the ground, they get shattered, and then they're put in crates and transported to Britain. Now, that scene, if you watched it, just without any commentary, as a film, you'd be disgusted, I think.
Got to be the final call. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your call, Eamon. This is got to be the final one. It's Dorothy who's joining us from Rathkill today. Hey, Dorothy.
Hi. Hello. I just wanted to say to Yanis, what a charming man, and the knowledge that he has of this, of Great Britain, Northern Ireland. I wish some of our politicians were as sensible as he sounds, anyway.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I spent 11 years living in this part of the world, and I grew up. I cut my teeth in important ways on these isles, and
really?
And Irish literature, British, Scottish music, and
Hang on a minute, Yanis. Dorothy, are you flirting a bit there?
Yes,
you are. I can detect that you are actually flirting from Rathgill down the phone line to Yanis Varoufakis.
Well, all I said was, if he looks as good as he sounds, my goodness.
Thank you so much. Thank
Dorothy,
you.
Dorothy, get yourself onto the Talkback Twitter feed. We've got a picture of him right there. BBC
right?
Talkback.
Okay.
Go have a look. Looks like she's
going to
be Googling you for the rest of the day.
Pleasure to speak to you anyway.
Lovely to talk to you, Dorothy. I don't get calls like that. Yanis, thank you very much. It's been lovely seeing you. And I'll see you tonight at the event.
Indeed.
Much appreciated.
Very much looking forward to it.